ACT Radio is taped and produced at the KTEP studios at the University of Texas at El Paso. The views and opinions expressed on ACT Radio are solely those of its participants and do not necessarily reflect those of KTEP, its staff, or management.
Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas, ACT Radio. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we discuss how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
We also discuss why a plant-based diet is not only the healthiest for us humans, it's also the best thing that we can do for our environment.
So if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas. Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with David Simon, author of the book Meatonomics, which examines the true cost of meat. That's coming up a little later on the show, but first some news.
The LA Times reports that the United States may be emitting 50% more methane, a potent greenhouse gas, than the federal government had previously estimated. And this is according to a new study that was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Though carbon dioxide from the combustion of fossil fuels is the main driver of climate change, and less methane than carbon is emitted overall, methane is an even more powerful heat-trapping gas than carbon. In April, the Environmental Protection Agency said that better pollution control by the oil and gas industry had resulted in an average annual decrease of 41.6 million metric tons of methane from 1990 to 2010. That was roughly 20% lower than earlier estimates by the agency. The EPA's findings bolstered supporters of the domestic oil and gas boom, who claimed that fossil fuels could be extracted without methane leaks and flaring, worsening greenhouse gas emissions. But the report this week from an international team of researchers tells a different story. Researchers found that methane from Texas, Oklahoma, and Kansas was 2.7 times higher than previously recorded, driven mainly by gas and oil development. Those three states alone account for nearly one quarter of U.S. methane emissions and almost 4% of the country's overall output of greenhouse gases, according to the study. The researchers also found that methane emissions from livestock are twice as high as earlier estimates. The study concluded that these results cast doubt on the U.S. EPA's recent decision to downscale its estimate of natural gas emissions by 25% to 30%.
Many of you may recall a few years back when the Petland Store of El Paso sued members of several local animal welfare organizations who sought to speak out against the sale of puppy mill dogs. The San Diego Reader reports a similar story from California. In a federal complaint, the owner of San Diego Puppy has attacked a citywide ban on the sale of dogs, cats, and rabbits at pet stores. David and Veronica Salinas, the owners of the pet store, located in Grantville, filed a lawsuit against the city, the local Humane Society, the San Diego Animal Legal Defense Team, and the Animal Protection and Rescue League. The ordinance is aimed at closing so-called puppy mills, commercial breeders often located in the Midwest, who have been found to ignore health requirements. But according to the Salinas' complaint, there are already laws in place to protect against neglect and mistreatment by breeders. According to that, all dogs sold at San Diego Puppy come with a certificate of health. According to the complaint, San Diego Puppy, the only retail pet store in the city that is or was selling purebred and other high-quality puppies that are not purported to be from a rescue or shelter retail facility, was irreparably harmed by the ordinance. It rejects the claim that San Diego Puppy buys and later sells dogs from auctions or imports them from other countries. On the contrary, they claim to deal directly with licensed breeders who are subject to government regulations. In regard to San Diego's ordinance, the complaint says that the local Companion Animal Protection Society targeted council members Lori Zapp and Marty Emerald upon learning that council members had antipathy towards animals. Their antipathy caused them to pursue adopting an ordinance. By filing the lawsuit, the Salinases hope to rescind the ordinance while at the same time keeping longtime animal rights activists from annoying, harassing, trespassing, threatening, or otherwise violating the peaceful operation of the business owned by the plaintiff David Salinas, and from threatening, harassing, or annoying any employee or officer of such businesses. So remember, if you're looking to bring home a companion animal into your home this holiday season, adopt, don't shop.
Last week, the Non-Human Rights Project filed lawsuits in the state of New York on behalf of four chimpanzees. The suits ask that the chimpanzees be granted the right to bodily liberty and that they be moved to a sanctuary where they can live out their days with others of their kind in a more natural environment. One of the chimps, Tommy, is being held captive in a cage in a shed at a used trailer lot in Gloversville, New York. The second chimp, Kiko, is deaf and living in a private home and suffers from mobility problems which resulted from early abuse. Two others, Hercules and Leo, are owned by a research center and are being used in experiments at Stony Brook University on Long Island. Several other chimpanzees who were to be included in the lawsuits have died before the legal actions could be brought before the courts. The legal course of action is the common law writ of habeas corpus, through which someone who is being held captive, for example in prison, seeks relief by having a judge call upon his captors to show cause as to why they have the right to hold him. The group which brought the lawsuits, the Non-Human Rights Project, says that their goal is to breach the legal wall that separates all humans from all non-human animals. They plan future lawsuits on behalf of whales and elephants who are being held in captivity. Stay with us. Coming up next on ACT Radio, we feature a conversation with David Simon, author of the book Meatonomics. David is a lawyer and an advocate for sustainable consumption, and he works as general counsel for a healthcare company and serves on the board of the Animal Protection and Rescue League. That's next on ACT Radio. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, David Simon. Dave, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Dave, can you tell our listeners how you got interested in animal issues?
Well, my interest in animal issues probably goes back 10 years or more when I was living in the Bay Area of California, and I saw a news report that a mountain lion had been shot and killed while sleeping in a tree. And I have to admit that it just kind of grabbed my attention because I knew that at the time, as they are now in some areas, mountain lions were considered endangered. At the time, the state population of mountain lions was about 4,000, and the population of people was about 35 million. And the incident just sort of made me aware of the way that we value human lives and animal lives differently. And I guess that sort of set me on path both to consider how humans interact with animals and to think about some of the economic issues.
The economic issues is a particular niche that hasn't been written about that much. And so it was great to see your book, Meatonomics, go into detail about the situation.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has yet added up all the hidden costs of animal agriculture in the way that I do in the book.
That must have been some number crunching you had to do to come up with those figures.
A lot of number crunching, yes.
Well, tell our listeners a little bit about some of the fascinating facts that you did uncover when you started to look into the true cost of meat production and animal agriculture in the U.S. and, I guess, globally as well.
Well, the main thing that drove my interest in this book was the idea that industries like animal agriculture and others typically externalize some portion of their costs. And what that means is very simple. If I take my garbage to the front of my driveway and leave it there for the garbage service to pick up, and then I pay them to pick it up, I internalize my garbage collection costs. But if instead I'd put my garbage in the trunk of my car and drive over to a park and dump it there at midnight and then race away, I have externalized my garbage collection costs, which is to say I've imposed my own costs of production or consumption onto society, and I've made taxpayers bear those costs.
Yes, but you've eliminated the need to pay the garbage man.
That's very true, and I will have brought my own expenses down considerably by doing that. What I find in this book is that the animal agriculture industry, more than any other industry in this country, externalizes vast portions of its costs, somewhere around $400 billion, which is about one quarter of Canada's gross domestic product. And that figure is larger than the known and published externalization figures for any other industry, including oil production, electricity generation, any of the big industries that you would think would have huge externalized cost figures.
How does the industry get away with doing this? I mean, what is it that consumers aren't able to do now that you would think would be able to change this paradigm?
Yeah, in the last three decades or so, the animal food industry has pushed very aggressively for laws at the state and federal level that allow it to externalize its costs. These laws basically surround the industry with a cocoon of economic protection. It's literally a framework that says we're allowed to externalize our costs on a society. And these are things like laws that eliminate all anti-cruelty protections for farmed animals that once exist, laws that make it difficult or impossible for consumers to investigate, criticize, or sue factory farmers, and other laws like that. And we're not used to thinking of laws as having economic value. That's just not sort of the conventional way that we look at them. But these are laws that have tremendous economic value and importance for this industry in particular, and these laws don't help consumers, and they certainly don't help animals. So these laws are on the books, and they help essentially one group, and that's animal food producers.
You hear a lot, too, about the subsidies that these producers get from the government as well. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how these subsidies work?
There is a complicated array of subsidies that most lay people have never even heard of. Many people are familiar with the idea of direct subsidies because in some ways these are the subsidies that are the most offensive. These are subsidies that over the last few decades have paid people who don't even farm, like the media guy Ted Turner, NBA star Scottie Pippen, people who own real estate that historically was used for farming but no longer is, have nevertheless continued to get these direct subsidies. But there are many, many other classes of subsidies with strange and sort of imposing names like milk loss contracts, crop insurance, irrigation subsidies, and they sound kind of bland and kind of blah, but they add up to huge dollars. If one adds up the state and federal subsidies to animal agriculture in this country, they come to about $38 billion each year. And to put that number in perspective, that's more than half of the unemployment benefits that all states paid to all unemployed workers last year.
I remember reading something years ago about subsidies that if animal agriculture didn't receive subsidies, hamburger would cost something like $30 a pound. And that doesn't even take into account all the figures that you've come up with. For example, the environmental consequences. Animal agriculture is not held accountable for destroying the environment.
No, it's generally not, for a variety of reasons, among other things because of the framework of state and federal laws that I touched on. In addition, there's sort of this phenomenon known as regulatory capture, where industries that are subject to state and federal regulation over time actually dominate the regulatory agencies that were put in place to regulate them. So the U.S. EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, for example, has a very difficult time regulating the discharge of waste into our nation's rivers, lakes, and streams by factory farms.
Yes, and many politicians have fought to disable the EPA and to label waste as a non-harmful substance.
That's right, although, as we know, it contains not only fecal bacteria like E. coli and Salmonella, but often antibiotics, hormones, and other things that we certainly don't want in our drinking water.
Well, and a lot of nutrients like nitrates, which are being found to be endocrine disruptors by the EPA recently. So, I mean, it's a huge source of nitrogen products in the environment.
Yeah, and those nutrients, those so-called nutrients, also contribute to all sorts of problems in local ecosystems where they cause eutrophication and algal blooms and hypoxic zones that make it difficult for fish and native vegetation to survive. And so it certainly is a major problem. So when I added up all the environmental costs, I basically got my hands on all of the published research that I could that showed environmental costs that relate to producing animal foods. And these are things in categories like water pollution, as we discussed, but also air pollution, land degradation related to largely erosion caused by grazing cattle or raising feed crops for cattle, the cost to mitigate climate change. Sure. Animal food production is a major contributor to climate change. And these figures all add up to about $37 billion per year.
Well, the climate change issue, a lot of people don't realize that how much methane production influences the climate change that we're seeing, and that one of the major sources of methane is from animal products, and that methane is a much more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, for instance.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think that some of the studies I've seen suggest that methane is 20 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
Something I saw in something you wrote online was that every time someone buys a Big Mac, it costs us each $8 in those hidden costs.
Yeah, I love that metric because it's very easy to visualize. So what I did is I took the total externalized costs that this industry generates, which as I mentioned is a little over $400 billion, and I compared it to the industry's annual retail sales, which is about $250 billion. And I come up with this formula that says for every $1 of product sold at retail, the animal food industry imposes about $1.70 of externalized costs onto taxpayers and consumers. So a $5 Big Mac really costs, in quotes, $13, because you have to add both the retail price and the externalized costs to come up with that number. And sort of on an average basis, one can do that calculation with any animal food. So a $12 rack of ribs ends up costing something like $28. And, you know, it's numbers that are so large that if we were really paying these numbers at the cash register, consumers would be buying much, much less of these goods than they are today.
What's really unfortunate is that we're not using those extra costs to pay for repair to the environment. We're just letting it go.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, there are ways to overcome that, and I propose one in the book, but certainly at the moment, the analogy is if you own a building, for example, and you let years and years go by without doing any maintenance on it, you've got a large so-called deferred maintenance accrual. Uh-huh. Well, our environment has a lot of deferred maintenance because we have been externalizing these costs for decades, and they've resulted in lots and lots of damage in lots of categories.
Well, and one of the categories, you know, that I think most people are, and me included, are really concerned about is water quality, because water is a finite resource on the planet, and it's very hard to remove some of these contaminants that you've mentioned earlier, and our freshwater resources are getting more and more limited as more and more people come onto the earth through reproduction. The amount of water per person is less and less, and the quality is getting degraded by all the excessive use in animal agriculture. It's just hard to get that concept across to people that are going to a fast food restaurant and buying a Big Mac, how much impact they're having on future water quality.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. And it's not just the quality of the water, it's the quantity of water consumed to produce animal foods, because it takes, depending on whose studies you believe, it takes somewhere between 40 and 100 times more water on a per-pound basis to produce animal protein than it does to produce plant protein. And in fact, it was sort of ironic for me, as I wrote last summer, while I was putting the finishing touches on writing this book, the summer of 2012, the state of Texas was in the middle of one of its worst droughts ever, and you may remember that.
Yeah, we do.
dozens of areas in the state had been declared disaster areas, and the ironic part of that is that Texas is the nation's largest beef producer. So although not all the cattle that ultimately comes out of Texas is raised in Texas, I did think that there was some irony in the fact that given these very disproportionate amounts of water needed to raise beef, that the state that raises the most beef had almost no water for its people to drink, to water their lawns, to raise other crops, etc.
Well, and a lot of cattle died because of the drought. There wasn't feed for them either. You know, I remember that in the news. A lot of the ranchers were complaining that they weren't able to provide food and water for their livestock. But, of course, as you mentioned, the scale of the agribusiness in Texas is just huge.
Oh, sure.
Well, I think it's funny that with the idea of the American West is that in ranchers and farming, it's a profession of independence and freedom from, you know, regulation of the government. And yet they're the ones who are primarily dependent upon, you know, these government regulations that you talk about in terms of, you know, government subsidies with irrigation and things like that. And I just think the idea is so strange that, you know, people have this notion of them being so independent from the U.S. system, but yet they are very dependent upon the U.S. and our taxpayers to foot the bill.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, they're the ones championing, leave us alone, let us do our thing. But they're reliant on those federal dollars.
How do they get together to lobby to keep the federal dollars coming into the coffers? Because obviously right now, you know, we've just been through a big economic recession. People are asked to cut back in all kinds of area. Unemployment's super high, but the subsidies to the agribusiness just keep on going. So how do you see their lobbyists being so effective? What are they doing?
The situation with subsidies is really crazy because while I was writing the book, I looked around for commentators who were praising the subsidies and saying, these are a good thing, we need these. And there's basically nobody saying that other than the big farmers themselves. Politicians on both sides of the aisle hate them. Everybody would like to see them go away. And yet every 4 or 5 years when a new farm bill is introduced and passed, lo and behold, the subsidies are locked down and included. One of the problems, or another way to look at it, is one of the tactical ways that producers have made sure that subsidies are here to stay is that they've put them into the same farm bill as the food stamp program, which is now called SNAP, or Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, so that in order for the urban lawmakers whose constituents are sort of disproportionately on food stamps, in order to get their food stamp dollars, they have to approve the subsidy dollars that the rural lawmakers want. So there's a lot of sort of quid pro quo or log rolling going on here, and these things are entrenched. It's very difficult to even change them.
And another ironic point is a lot of the food stamps, a lot of the products in those stores are animal agriculture products that are produced in too much abundance. Milk and cheese, a lot of those products are produced in quantities much more that can be used, and they go straight to these federal programs like school lunches and the food stamps program.
That's very true. And to put even a finer point on that, because by definition, those who are eligible for food stamps are typically in lower socioeconomic groups, there's also some sad irony in the fact that clinical research shows that those in these lower socioeconomic groups are more prone to diseases like obesity and diabetes, which the research also shows are more closely related to animal foods. So there's just this skewed set of purchasing cues that are given to the poor by keeping the prices of animal foods artificially low. It keeps them coming back, and it keeps them consuming. And it keeps them consuming way too much. You know, the United States, on a per-person basis, consumes more meat than any other country in the world.
Except Luxembourg, I believe. They claim that it's because other people from other nations come to their nation buy meat.
That's right.
So
I address that with I usually just treat that with a footnote. I don't consider it statistically significant.
So it sounds like cheap food really isn't cheap.
No.
You know, something else about the farm bill. It would be so much better if they could divide it up rather than include it all together, because something we've seen in recent years is all the ag gag laws tacked onto the farm bill, preventing us from criticizing animal agriculture.
Well, that's right. And this year, there's an even worse rider attached to the farm bill. This is a rider that would essentially emasculate all of the state animal welfare protections that have been enacted over the last several years, including a very important one in California. And it's unclear whether that's going to pass in its current form, but it's certainly disappointing to think that that Farm Bill is used as a vehicle to try to eliminate welfare protections that, that states have worked very hard to pass.
And this is the King Amendment, is that right?
That's right.
Well, it sounds like writing the book, you had to really delve into a lot of different areas. And which area did you find most difficult to get a grip on the actual externalized costs of meat production?
Well, probably the area of ecology, just because there are a lot of PhDs writing in that field, and some of the literature is quite arcane, difficult to parse it out. I was fortunate that I had a lot of help from some experts who read the manuscript and gave me some great advice. But yeah, there's a lot of technical information in there. The book actually has more than 700 citations or endnotes to sources, mostly in published research or government reports.
And it seems like it would be impossible to place a cost on the destruction of the oceans, which are overfished and include so many new dead zones.
Yeah, you know, you're really right. That was one of the disappointing subjects for me as I wrote the book. I do include a category for sort of ocean-related damage that I call fish production, but it's just because the published research is not available yet to really show the true economic costs related to damage to the oceans resulting from fishing. The number that I put in there is just a tiny fraction of what I believe the true number is.
True. What costs the planet?
Yeah.
Dave, we only have a few moments left. I hope you could come back and do our next show with us.
I would love to.
Okay. And in the meantime, can you tell our listeners a website where they can find more information about your book and your...
Yeah, absolutely. There's a website and blog at meatonomics.com, just like meatonomics, all one word, .com. And I also have a Facebook page at facebook.com/meatonomics.
Great. Well, thanks for being with us, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
And we'll see you next time. If you'd like to learn more about a plant-based diet, please visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso's website. That's VSEP.org.
And as the holidays approach, think of compassionate alternatives that are also environmentally friendly when you're planning your holiday meals and gift-giving. Here at ACT Radio, we have our favorite places to shop for compassionate and earth-friendly products, and we share links for some of these places at our webpage at ktep.org.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them also at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button.
Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh for the Animals, the Earth, and a Healthier Humanity. Thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas. Mm-hmm.